conversations of inspiration.
Hi, I'm Jordan Hussey, Executive Director of Jay's Place Recovery Center in Gainesville, Georgia. This is our premiere episode of our podcast that we are calling The Journey. We are excited about the conversations we've already recorded and those we plan to have. Sometimes we will have a video, so I guess that means sometimes it's a vlog. But always, we will be discussing things that you have told us you want to hear to support those in recovery and to educate our community at large. For our first episode, we wanted to take a look at how Jay's Place got started. So we sat down with Northeast Georgia Health System's Deb Bailey. Once again, I'm Jordan Hussey from Jay's Place Recovery Center. And today we're here with Deb Bailey. Deb, you actually work for the Northeast Georgia Health System. What exactly is your title there?
In layman's terms, it's my responsibility to negotiate the Georgia General Assembly and Washington, D.C. as it relates to legislation that impacts our organization, whether that's for our nurses, for our physicians, reimbursement, any of those types of things.
Wow, that's incredible. And, you know, I feel really fortunate that we have you here in this community doing that work and advocating on our behalves, because I know that, you know, the health system here takes the entire community into account.
Well, it's not usually a goal of someone's. It's not an aspiration to be a lobbyist, because we don't have really good reputations for the most part. So it wasn't a goal of mine, as a matter of fact, when they just needed somebody that had a big mouth. And so I said, okay, I'll go down for one legislative session. And then, now 25 years later, I'm still down there. I loved it. I did find out that I had a really big mouth and that I could use it. But my mother had told me that for a long time. So, but I came actually into this position with a background in nursing. And so I've been a nurse for now over 40 years, but was actually a nursing assistant in nursing homes when I at 14. So I've been in healthcare my entire life. And I think I was probably drawn to it. I think there's some statistics, and I probably wouldn't be accurate now, but at some time in the past, I know that it was said that 50% of all nurses, and that is my background, I am a nurse by education, that 50% of all nurses were children of alcoholics. So we, of course, grow into, and I don't know that statistic now, so yeah. For you folks out there, if you go look it up, at one time it was correct. But it was a motivating factor for me. My father was an alcoholic, and I think you learn to be a caregiver. And as a middle child, you learn to be not only a caregiver, but a peacekeeper in the family, and that's your role.
Truly. I love the statistic that you shared, because I was thinking my grandmother and both of her sisters all were nurses. Mm-hmm. And my great-grandfather, their father, mm-hmm. was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that makes sense, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was granted a long time ago, and I think that it was either nursing or teaching probably at the time. But mm-hmm. but I also really appreciate your being vulnerable like that, talking about, you know, your parents and the history. And I think that so many times we don't acknowledge past trauma as impacting the way that, you know, we think, the way that we behave, our careers, you know, I think it's time that we speak about it, you know, and you yourself are not a person in long-term recovery from substance use or alcoholism, but you are what we would call an ally. And so, and it sounds like for you that may have started with your dad.
I think it started with my dad, but I can only say that now. I really think it was more about my mother, because it was interesting. She was the glue that held these five children together, because my dad drank, and he was a very kind alcoholic, a very quiet, very meek, very peaceful person. But he was also had been a prisoner of war. And so I always thought, well, of course, I'd want to drink too. And then I thought, well, if I lived with my mother, I'd want to drink too, because she was mean. And so the anger was never at my father. The anger was at my mother. It took me a long time to look at the dynamics of that. But where it led me was to be not only a nurse, but to start my career as a psychiatric nurse. A psychiatric nurse and on a drug and alcohol unit. So that was my first job out of nursing school. And I remember my nursing professors going like, do not go there. Do not go there. You belong in med-surg nursing. You're going to be a wonderful nurse. Don't waste yourself there. And I thought, wow, that's their perspective. I mean, and even because I'm a little older, I spent time at what was then Milledgeville Central State Hospital with the door locked behind us. And I didn't know until later in life how depressed I was in nursing school, and I couldn't figure it out. My thought was, I hate nursing school, and I do not want to be a nurse. But what I was struggling with the most, I realized later, was the identification that I had with these people that I was taking care of. And I was always in my head, what is the difference between me and them? What is the difference between, at that time we were doing electric shock therapies on people on the unit. And I might do 20 in that morning. And I was the nurse that gave the IV and put the electrodes to the head. And I remember the first time I'd been in the operating room. I'd seen all this blood and I'd seen all this. Didn't bother me a bit. When we did that first electric shock therapy, I hit the ground. I fainted. What's the difference of this? Why am I different from this woman? And I remember she probably was only 3 or 4 years older than me. And I realized there isn't any difference. And then that's when I kind of fell to my knees, being truly grateful for my mother that had made me a soldier. You know, I was like, okay, you know, daddy was a soldier, and you know, your five children are soldiers, and this is what we do. But I never ever, I did that for a couple of years and then went away from that. But that has been the thread that has motivated me in that psychiatric nursing experience and what I learned there, and what I learned from the people that I worked with and cared for has created the person that I have become. And it has never, ever left me. And so that's why later in life, when I've had the opportunity at the Georgia General Assembly to be with the Neil Campbells of the world, which is the executive director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse, to be with these people and to recognize what we have in our community, in Gainesville, how blessed we are, and what we didn't have. And to realize, wow, we're the number one heart center, you know, for the state of Georgia for 10, 12 years in a row. And darn, here it is 35, 40 years later, and we're treating these people the same way that we treated them 35, 40 years. It made me furious. And I thought, what do we do about it? And all you have to do is, when you think, what do you do about it? Just open your eyes and somebody walks across the path in front of you and you go like, oh, that's what we do. So we had the opportunity to do a grant with we being Northeast Georgia Health System, to do a grant with the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse for peer coaches in the emergency department. And that was 4 or 5 years ago now, $500,000 grant. Fortunately, I do work for a system that valued that. So it didn't take a long time. And then once again, we had just brought in a new executive director of the emergency department. And I think had we not done that, I don't know that that part of this effort would have been successful, because she was very vulnerable in saying, you know, I have a family member, I have experience with this, and this is a wonderful thing. So we started with the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse in Gainesville about 4 or 5 years ago. We spent almost 9 months getting everything in place for to put peer coaches in the emergency department. And for those of you that do not know what peer coaches in the emergency department are, it's recovering people that are 2 years clean and sober and that have finished a CARES course. And we brought those into our emergency department, and since then they've seen maybe 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 of their peers, and we're still the only one in the state that's doing that. I think that's I hate that, because I think other communities are missing an amazing opportunity. But we were able to do that. There were hurdles there. When you think about emergency room nurses, you don't really think about nurses that want to care for either psychiatric patients or patients with overdose or substance abuse. They like to deal with the car wrecks. They like to deal with the blood and the guts, and that's who they are.
And these are the people that the peer coaches are seeing, right? Or people who come in with overdoses, people who come in with side effects as a result of drinking alcohol, maybe their whole life, right?
Yes. So that's who they see every day.
So thousands since inception to now.
Yes.
I mean, that's incredible.
Yes.
That's incredible.
What has been incredible is for you to be able to see these individuals come in and see a peer of their own, and how differently they can respond to that peer, and the value of that interaction over the value of an interaction with a nurse or a physician that has multiple skills, but they don't have the connection that a peer that has said, I've been here, I know what this is like. Or they might say, you can't bullshit me on that, because I know I've been here. And you, but that relationship creates an environment that's conducive to the beginning of a healing process.
And especially, I mean, there's some credit to be had, you know, to say, not only have I been there, but I was probably worse than you. And look where I am today. And if I can do this, you can do this. And I believe in you. And they do things like I know that the peer coaches follow up via phone call in person with these people that they're seeing, and they stay in contact and keep that connection going right long after they leave the hospital.
That is part of their position and their job description, that not only do they see those people in the emergency department, and you can think that has to be very difficult for them too. And we were very, very cautious in the beginning, making sure that these peer coaches had what they needed to deal with this on a daily basis. That's difficult. The emotional arousal that's created time after a time to be dealing with that. But yes, it is part of their role to not only see that individual in the acute environment and crisis situation, but to follow them up in the community and to find them resources in the community to change their life and to connect with others, which is mandatory for the healing process. The connection to a community like Jay's Place is absolutely mandatory to part of the healing process. I never believed that we can do this alone. We cannot do this alone, regardless of how strong we believe we are. I just don't think we humans are built that way.
You know, you've actually been around right from the beginning of Jay's Place. And so let's talk, you kind of hit on a little bit about the inception of that and you know, how one organization just totally benefits the other and we kind of intertwine together and work so well together. But how did that start out for this community to have Jay's Place?
There were two things that were going on at the same time. We started that relationship with the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse and had the peer coaches in the emergency department at the same time that we put together a coalition of community members that around what started with Dallas Gay as prevention of opioid overdoses. So those two things were parallel and synergistic, I believe, because we got a lot of attention in the community as we started our forums, when 400 to 500 people would come up in this community for a forum on opioid overdose. So both of those things were going on at the same time. And then we also had these amazing neonatal nurses that were on top of it. And so before I answer your question to Jay's Place, I'll put one more step in there as we work towards that. And that was that we had these great neonatal nurses that had already recognized that we had these addicted moms and addicted babies and that we needed to do something. So we were successful in bringing up a whole group of state senators and in working with Brittany Smith in the nursery. We manipulated the heck out of it. So we were like, we are going to not only bring these state senators up, but we're going to meet in the nursery, right outside the nursery, and we're going to tour the nursery. And what state senators can say no to newborn babies, and particularly addicted newborn babies? So we brought them up, and the neonatal nurses did an amazing job of selling that we needed peer coaches in the nursery also. And so we were able at the Georgia General Assembly to talk them into and very grateful for their generosity of another grant, a $250,000 grant that's actually just state funds to fund NICU peer coaches, and that has been a tremendous, it's been an amazing thing that our community has done. We are now still the only ones in the United States that's doing that, and those nurses have presented across the United States what they're doing. They've decreased the length of stay of an addicted baby from at the beginning, which was like a 36-day length of stay for those babies. I think we're down to about 9, sometimes 7 to 9 days that baby is. And the other thing, and they will tell you, the nurses will tell you, that they didn't want to have a bias towards those moms or dads, but they did. And they were very, if I can say it, they were very pissed off at these people coming in and, why can't you do this for your baby? And we have changed that entire attitude around in our system, and a real recognition that those moms that come in now know that we understand that they have an illness, and that we recognize that for what it is, where they are, and that we are there to help them. So I think we all have to know, for changes to occur, that judgment has to be removed. So the judgment, as when I talk about how wonderful it is that these babies are going home to their moms, the judgment has melted away. And those nurses and physicians will tell you that is part also of healing our individuals in our community. So that's been an amazing thing that they've done. So out of that, we recognized, well, we have peer coaches in the emergency department. We have peer coaches in the nursery. We're trying to find places in our community for resources in our community for these people that we're referring out. And we have amazing resources in our community. We never knew how many until we started looking. But we also had a need that we still didn't have a place like Jay's Place in our community, a recovery center. So we visited several. We went and visited one in Rome. We visited one in Marietta. And we were like, we want one of these. You know, we need one of these. So once more, we went to the Georgia General Assembly. We wrote a grant. They were starting to fund several more. So in that grant process, I think we had, what, a 3-week deadline to pull this together.
I've been in recovery long enough to see that in the beginning, there was not this belief that it was a disease. There was not this acceptance that a person could change. It was, you know, they have low morals, or they're, you know, just... And especially a mom who's using while pregnant, you know, there's clearly a hijack of the brain that happens there. But I also know as a mom that there's a lot of shame and guilt in the choices that we make, especially when we're choosing a substance over ourselves or our children. But it sounds like that culture change came from within. You know, before the peer coaches even arrived.
We really didn't know what we didn't know about the cultural changes. I don't think we could have even thought that, oh, our goal is to change our culture. It was an evolutionary process that evolved out of the absolute mutual respect for the professionals that work there, and now this new profession that had begun, and a recognition for what these people brought. that created a cultural change that could not have been learned or educated, for lack of a better description, it's not something that you can do. To me, that's like, I'm going to teach you how to be empathic. If that's not your nature, to be empathic, it's going to be hard. But if you watch people do it over time and you understand that, oh, that's what that means, I can become that. So that cultural change was an amazing grace note that came out of the evolutionary process of this, that we recognized and realized the value of, but we didn't bring it to the table. I think the other huge piece of that cultural change was the forums that we were able to do and the education. I remember in that first forum when we had 400 to 500 people there, and we asked the people in the room to stand up if you had been touched by this. And there was no one in the room that was left seated. And I think that those things are also in our community what we embraced, as that it's no longer hiding in plain sight next door. There is no one in our community that this has not touched. So let's just stop pretending that my family ain't got a problem with this, or my neighbor. And I think in doing that, that might be just as big, because it impacted so many other people, of everybody recognizing this is a societal issue that our community is dealing with, and doggone it, let's step up to the plate. You know, we step up to the plate for heart disease. We're doing this for diabetes. Let's step up to the plate, because lives are being lost, families are being broken apart, and people are suffering, and they don't have to be. And if they are suffering, they certainly don't have to be suffering alone. And that's the part that Jay's plays in not ever having to be alone. There is a place in our community for you to go to have a community that's a resource to you.
You know, I think back on like how many people this community has lost, young people in this community that they've lost to opioid overdoses. And I know that meth has kind of taken a big uptick recently. But, you know, I think that families in general and the community in general have gotten to this place of, and probably have been here for a while, of enough is enough. We want to stand up and do something, you know, to save the lives of our children and our families and our loved ones. And we, you know, our voice can be heard, but I don't sing to the Capitol, you know. I don't reach those depths, but I know that that you do. You get that opportunity to speak up and kind of be heard as a representative for our community and the recovery community, and we're truly grateful for that. Deb, I just want to take the opportunity to thank you so much for carving out some time out of your schedule to come and be here with us today and to talk about this.
It's a tremendous opportunity for me to be here today too.
Thanks again for joining us for our first podcast. Our very own Greg O'Hara wrote and recorded our theme song. Be sure to give him some encouragement when you see him.
Take you on a journey, yeah. At Jay's Place.